Thank you very much, Alistair, for that introduction again, and good morning. As we tackle this challenging and fascinating topic of dependence, just to say that the handouts for these sessions are available on the website, and much of the text that's on the PowerPoint is there in the handout, so you don't need to write it all down. So the text for this morning's session, the second session, is the well-known text in the second letter to the Corinthians. Paul says, "So we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away. Our inner self is being renewed day by day. For our light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." So the image for these seminars is the image of a marathon race, of the runners coming towards the end of the 26 miles. They're in the stadium. There are people cheering as they come towards the finishing line. And just very briefly, to recap some of the messages and the lessons that we tried to learn yesterday, the idea that each one of us is running a race which has been individually marked out for us. We need perseverance. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And there's likely, as in any long-distance race, there's likely to be struggle and suffering and difficulties ahead. We're not alone. There's a great cloud of witnesses cheering us on, both in heaven but also here on earth. It's a race involving all the members of the Christian family. We need to learn more about fixing our eyes on Jesus. It always strikes me how, as the runners are coming and everyone's cheering, most of the runners are not waving at the crowd and their eyes are just fixed where they're going, straight ahead, looking to the finishing line. And ultimately, the race is all about joy. So as we come to this question of dependence, what strikes me is how many of us, including Christian believers, have this strong desire to be self-reliant, to be independent, to do it ourselves. And I hear a lot of people say, "I just don't want to be a burden to other people. I'm very happy to care for other people. I'm very happy to be there for other people. But if I ever get so that I become a burden, so that other people need to care for me, then I'm just going to say, thank you, Lord. It's time to go to heaven now. Bye-bye. Good night." And superficially, that may sound spiritual and altruistic. But actually, I'm convinced it's wrong. And I'm convinced that actually our thinking has been much more infected by secular ideas which come from the Enlightenment, ideas that philosophers call autonomy, autonomos, which literally means I make my own rules. I live my own life. I do it my way. And I think we've Christianized, many of us have Christianized this kind of thinking. We want to serve Christ, but we want to do it our way. We want to be independent and self-directing and self-choosing. But God designed us to be dependent. It's actually part of our creation. It's the way that we've been made. And this is very clear in those early chapters in Genesis. The Hebrew word for human, the human, Adam, is derived from the Hebrew word for ground, Adama. And so literally, we are groundlings. That's what the Hebrew says. And did you know the same is true in English? That the word human is derived from humus. Not the nice stuff you put on pita bread, but the compost heap. That's what we are. That's what it means to be human, made out of humus. And what that means is that we are designed by God to be frail, to be dependent, to be limited, to be vulnerable, and to use a philosophical term, to be contingent, which means we are affected by events, chance events. And what's clear is that this is all part of creation. It's not the consequence of the fall. This happens before the fall. And God makes us, as human beings, frail, vulnerable, and dependent. And, of course, it didn't happen to be that, have to be that way. God could have chosen to make us powerful, glorious, and dynamic. I sometimes think of the cherubim in that vision that Isaiah had of the temple. And do you remember? The cherubim are crying to God, holy, holy, holy. And the entire temple is shaking with the power of their voices. Well, God could have made us like that. And instead, he chose to make us these pathetic carbon-based life forms made out of dust, vulnerable and fragile. And so, why is that? Because we are designed to be dependent on one another. You came into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of other people. The very fact that you're sitting there looking reasonably together, as I look out there, tells me that when you were born, somebody loved you. Somebody cared for you. Somebody fed you. Somebody kept you warm. Somebody wiped your bottom. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting there. You could do nothing for yourself. Then we go through this phase of our life when other people depend on us. And sometimes that phase of life seems to go on a very long time. We've got three grown-up boys. They've all left home. You say, oh, thank goodness that. Now we can get on with our lives. And then the phone rings. Dad, could you put £1,000 in my account, Dad? You know, so this period of dependence seems to go on an awful long time. But, you know, most of us are going to end our lives utterly, totally dependent on the love and care of others. And this is not some terrible, tragic, dehumanizing reality. No, this is part of the way it was meant to be. This was brought home to me very memorably when my own mother, and this is a story I've told before here at Keswick, my own mother, who was a lovely, vivacious Christian servant, was struck down by a rapidly progressing form of dementia. And in front of our eyes, she was transformed into someone who became utterly and totally dependent. And she was confused, she was hallucinating, she required 24-hour nursing care. And near the end, I was visiting her, and somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon into my hand. And I can remember I was trying to feed her. Open your mouth, here it comes, open your mouth. And then I suddenly had a flashback. This was exactly what she used to do for me. In fact, I could even remember her words and her finger coming out and wiping my mouth as a little child. And now the tables were turned. And I remember vividly at the time thinking, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it meant to be a son. And she was learning more of what it meant to be a mother, because dependence is part of the story. And so if you hear someone say, I just don't want to be a burden to anyone, or if you're tempted to think it yourself, then gently what you should say is push back and say, you are wrong. You're designed to be a burden to me. And I'm designed to be a burden to you. And the life that God has given us is one of mutual burdensomeness. And that's why Paul says, carry one another's burdens, and in this way, you will fulfill the law of Christ. And I do think this is an amazing opportunity for us as we come to this final lap of our lives to learn more about this very countercultural way of living. You know, in a society which is so obsessed with independence, with autonomy, with I do it my way, and if I can't do it my way, then frankly, my life is not worth living. This is one of the main reasons now in why there's a push for the legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide. It's because people are terrified of dependence, terrified of becoming dependent on other people. And yet, if the Christian community could live in a way which demonstrated this mutual burdensomeness, then I think that would be an amazing witness for a cynical and secular age. And theologian Gilbert Mylander wrote a whole article where he says, I want to burden other people. And he says, is this not in large measure what it means to belong to a family, to burden each other, and to find almost miraculously that others are willing, even happy, to carry such burdens? And yet the truth is, many of us fear the onset of dependence. I don't want to sanitize or imply that there aren't real issues here, that there isn't pain and loss and struggle associated with dependence. We can't sentimentalize it or romanticize it. Yes, there's a profound spiritual truth that we're designed to be dependent on others, but the reality can feel distressing, painful, and humiliating. Some years ago, I developed a severe psychiatric illness, and I ended up in a locked psychiatric ward. And it was an intensely humiliating and painful and distressing experience. In my depression, I became convinced that my whole life, my professional career, everything that I'd worked for had been destroyed. And it was a terrible experience, a kind of personal hell. And if you talked to me at that time about the love of God, then God was just a word with three letters. It meant nothing. But what I discovered, there was something that could penetrate into that deep, dark pit of despair. And that was the fact that I was still loved by human beings. That realization penetrated through. My wife came to the ward and just cuddled me. And my spiritual father, John Stott, tracked me down and telephoned me in the locked ward and said, I value your friendship, John. And it brought tears to my eyes then, and it still does. So I learned from that painful time, I learned that however deep the pit, however locked people are in their own suffering, human love can penetrate. And in fact, as we care for others, we're called to represent God's invisible love in human form. Again, this is a story I've told before, but the story is of the little girl who's going to sleep in the bedroom, and it's very dark, and she's a bit scared, and she calls down to her mummy, who's downstairs. Mummy, mummy, I'm scared. It's dark in here. Can you come and give me a cuddle? And mummy says, no, no, darling, I'm very busy. I'm sorry, I can't come and cuddle you. And then, well, can daddy come and give me a cuddle? No, no, daddy is not here at the moment. But then, because mummy is a very spiritual lady, she says, just remember that God is with you in the bedroom, and he will give you a cuddle. And then there's a pause, and then this little voice comes down the stairs. But mummy, I need someone with skin on. And I love that story because it's a very profound story. Because we are physical beings, because we're made out of flesh, because we're made out of humus, we need God's love to be revealed in physical form. We need physical arms around us. We need to hear physical words of comfort and reassurance and love. And the amazing privilege of those of us who are called to care for other people is that we can be God's love with skin on, just representing in a physical form his care and his compassion. For me, there was a long and slow process of psychiatric, mental, and spiritual recovery and healing, and that continued over many years. And as I was recovering, I was reminded of some words that Bernard of Clairvaux wrote years in the medieval period. And he said this, "Christ himself kisses us in the love of our friends. Christ himself kisses us in the love of our friends." And I realized that Christ himself was reaching out to me in that ward, but he was reaching out through the love of those who cared for me. So as we approach a period when we become dependent on others, we need to see that despite the suffering and despite the humiliation, this can be part of God's calling on our lives. Because now as I look back on that period of dependence and the pain and the humiliation and the confusion, I now see that it was actually a strange gift, a gift that I desperately didn't want. And yet, through it, God has allowed me to learn more of his love, more of his care, more of his presence, and also ways of sharing with others. That's why I'm talking about it now, because I know that many other people have similar experiences, struggle with mental health issues and depression and despair. And yet together, we can bear one another's burdens. So these are issues that we need to discuss openly with our loved ones and with our professionals and plan ahead before the crisis strikes. You know, what I'd noticed, I mentioned this yesterday, is that so many of the previous generation, the generation that went through the war, so many of them were just desperate to hang on to the last moment, to say, I want to stay in my own house, I want to do it my way, I don't want any charity, I don't want any help. That desperately clinging on. And you know, what we've learned, the next generation, is that that's not a healthy way of dealing with the onset of dependence. Instead, we need to plan ahead. There are obviously a whole load of practical issues. We need to think about financial issues, legal issues, what kind of accommodation would be best for us as we're approaching dependence, what are going to be our medical, our care needs, what kind of social support, what kind of spiritual support will we need, what can we do now to plan ahead, to prepare for the future. But we remind ourselves of this lovely quote from Ian Knox, "A long life is a gift, not a curse. It's full of possibilities, and the gift is the gift of time." So God makes us these fragile, vulnerable, dependent beings. But he doesn't just say, okay, well, I've made you like this. You know, good luck with that. It's going to be tough. It's going to be hard being made out of dust, but, you know, all the best. No, something far more amazing, far more wonderful happens, because the God himself, the God of total power and authority and glory, chooses to make himself a human being made out of dust, made out of humus. And so God in human form is born as a pathetic, fragile baby, and he can do nothing for himself. And he needs human arms to cuddle him and to clothe him and to wipe his bottom and to keep him warm. And he needs a human mother to feed him. He entrusts his entire human existence to fallible human beings. You know, we're so familiar with the Christmas story and all that nice stuff of Bethlehem and stables and all that, that we have lost how utterly scandalous it is that the God of total power and authority turns himself into a real baby? A real baby that wheezes and squits down his mother's front? I mean, really? You know, when the first Christians started telling the message of the incarnation to all the sensible philosophers and thinkers of the time, that was just disgusting. I mean, really? That the God of the universe is a human baby? And yet that's the whole point. It's so ridiculous that it might just be true. It is true. God made himself vulnerable. And yet, he is still the second person of the Trinity. He is still upholding the universe by the word of his power, even when he is utterly dependent. Both he's dependent at the beginning of his life, but then at the end of his life, he voluntarily chooses to make himself dependent again. And there's a Greek word that is used, which is normally translated betrayed. That word that Jesus is betrayed happens repeatedly. And the Greek word is paradidomi. But actually, it really means that Jesus is handed over. He hands himself over to others. And many biblical commentators have pointed out that isn't it strange that although in the three other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there is all an account of the transfiguration when Jesus' glory is most revealed in a spectacular way on earth, in John's Gospel, which is most about the glory of God, the transfiguration account is not there. So where is the transfiguration? Where is Christ's glory revealed most fully in John's Gospel? And what some writers have suggested is that paradoxically, the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ is most revealed when Jesus voluntarily hands himself over in the Garden of Gethsemane. And if we look to John chapter 18, this is what the literal Greek says. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, the people who've come to capture him, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. And in the Greek, this is what it says, "I am," Jesus said. And Judas, the one who handed him over, and that's that Greek word, paradidomi, was standing there with them. And when Jesus says, "I am," they draw back and fall to the ground. There is the glory. But it's revealed paradoxically as Jesus hands himself over to dependence. So Christ's divine status and dignity is in no way impaired by his dependence, by being handed over. In fact, it's precisely through his dependence that his divine glory is displayed to all, including those who wish him harm. So there's something very, very important for us to learn here, and that is that to be dependent on others is not a degrading and dehumanizing process. In fact, in the painful reality of dependence, we experience a tiny reflection of what God, out of love, chose for himself. He chose to make himself dependent. And so wonderfully, God's glory can be revealed in our dependence. And at the end of John's Gospel, the message is reinforced. And this is when Jesus is meeting with Peter after the resurrection. And three times Peter has to say, that he loves him because he's betrayed Jesus himself. And so after that, Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you don't want to go." And then the vital bit, Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." Now, of course, we know that Peter's death as an apostle in some way was unique. There are these traditions that he was crucified, but he refused to be crucified in the normal way and insisted he was crucified upside down. And yet, I think there is a lesson for all of us here that actually, in the later stages of our life, when we allow ourselves in a godly way to become dependent, we can glorify God too. In our dependence, we can show forth the glory. And so, in this strange mystery, suffering and glory are so often twinned together, both in the scriptures and in our Christian experience. They're two sides of the same coin. In suffering, there is glory. In glory, there is suffering. But we mustn't, as I said, sentimentalize or glamorize dependence. The reality is frequently painful and distressing and frustrating, and our dependence on others may feel humiliating. But the example and model that Christ provides teaches us that our dignity and our status, our identity as a person, cannot be lost or damaged or demeaned. So we need to remember this, don't we, sisters and brothers? At some time in the future, it's very likely that many of us will find ourselves in a hospital bed or a care home, and we too need to be washed. We too need to be fed. We too need to have our bottoms wiped. But your unique dignity and status as a beloved princess or prince of the Most High is in no way touched or demeaned. Nothing can take away that away. And we too, by God's grace, may experience something of the glory. So physician John Dunlop wrote this: "There is an essential humility that makes us willing to be served. The attitude that says, 'No, no, I don't want other people to look after me,' actually can be an inverted kind of pride. Christians should have learned at the time of their salvation that they can do nothing to save themselves, that they're totally dependent on God. So throughout our life, we need to be learning the same lesson. Throughout life, a desire for self-sufficiency can impair spiritual growth." Now, there's a hard lesson for those of us who want to be independent. A desire for self-sufficiency can impair spiritual growth. At the end of life, it's good to be less self-sufficient and trust God more fully. Finding the balance between freedom and dependence. So it's not that freedom is not significant. As human beings, we are created for freedom as well as dependence. And so as carers, we don't want to be suffocating in our care. We want to allow those we're caring for to encourage them, to facilitate them, their freedom. We aim to respect their rights to choose, to allow people to make choices as much as possible. So there's this balance between respecting freedom whilst accepting dependence. As we enter into the final lap of our race, we're called gradually and voluntarily to give up our freedom to others, to let go progressively and graciously, rather than hanging on until our freedom is ripped away from us against our will. and this is physician John Dunlop again, many of the losses associated with aging are inevitable and often forced upon us. But some things we can choose to give up voluntarily. And when we can see the losses coming, I have observed that it's much better to recognize them, plan for them, and make changes somewhat gradually and proactively, rather than waiting for a crisis to force a drastic change. I think there's great wisdom in that, recognizing that the losses are coming and then planning and making changes gradually and proactively rather than waiting for a crisis. And then finally, this wonderful biblical spiritual gift, contentment. In 1 Timothy 6, Paul says, "Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we could take nothing out of it." And in Philippians chapter 4, Paul says, "I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content." I had the great privilege of accompanying my spiritual father, John Stott, who was very well known here in Keswick, as he himself realized that he was becoming increasingly dependent. And he chose, again, proactively and gradually, to be transferred into an institution, St. Barnabas, the College of St. Barnabas, which was caring particularly for elderly clergy and other workers in the Church of England. And he realized that he was losing his energy, but also some of his faculties. He had always such an intelligent, incisive mind, a wonderful memory for names and people. And then he found himself increasingly losing that and losing his ability to speak. And that was so painful for him. To realize that these gifts were being taken away and that his, in many aspects, his Christian ministry was coming to an end. And when he was asked, this is what he would say, "I would not say that I am happy, but I am learning to be content." And so, contentment, recognizing that this is God's plan for our lives. Yes, it may be painful. Yes, it may be difficult. Yes, it may be frustrating, but actually, there are things to learn here. There's more to learn. I sometimes hear an old Christian person saying, "You know, I keep praying to God, please take me to heaven. I'm ready to go to glory. I want to see your face. I pray every day, Lord, take me to heaven. Take me to heaven. Please take me to heaven." And yet, he doesn't take me. And again, it sounds spiritual, but actually, you know, I think that is a form of despair. Because what that person is really saying is, "I have nothing more to learn, and I have nothing more to give." And so when someone says that to me, I try to empathize and be sympathetic and so on, but then I say gently, "Well, perhaps the reason you're still here is because either you got more to learn or you got more to give. So how about trying to find what that is?" So yesterday we looked at this question, what are old people for? And we came up with a number of suggestions. And the wonderful thing is that as we go through the list of some of the things that we came up with yesterday, that what old people are for, it turns out that we can carry on doing these things even in dependence. So what was it? Well, there was prayerfulness, especially for the younger generations. There was being a listening ear, of having increased availability for others. There was investing in friendships. especially intergenerational friendships with younger people. There's offering life wisdom in a non-judgmental way. There's sharing our faith and hope in Christ with others, including our carers. There's expressing gratitude and thankfulness, especially for the little things and the blessings of creation. There's providing a positive model of letting go graciously. There's hopefulness, pointing towards the future and the hope of resurrection. There's leaving behind a legacy of wisdom, a testimony to God's faithfulness. Isn't it wonderful that being dependent will not stop us from any of those things that old people are for? We can still glorify God even in our weakness and dependence. And so as we close, and now there'll be a time for questions and discussion. So we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For our light, momentary affliction, yes, there is affliction, there is the struggle, there is suffering, there is pain. This light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. So as we approach this late stage of our lives, increasingly we need to develop the ability to see beyond the surface, to see beyond the surface appearance. You know, as we watch those we love, as we watch our own bodies, and we see those wrinkles, and we see that all that evidence of aging, and sag, and all the other things that comes along with age. And it's easy to become appalled and revolted and to say, this is not what I want. And yet, what we need is to have these spiritual eyes that can see beyond the surface and see the beauty that lies behind. I'm reminded of a story that Rico Tice at All Souls told me, and that was, there was an older lady who'd been a member of All Souls for many years, a very faithful and godly lady, but had never had any kind of public role, but she'd just been a faithful member of the church and a carer and supporter of others. And then she developed a terminal illness. She lived alone. She was admitted to hospital. And she'd been there for several weeks. And Rico was going to visit her in the hospital. And he goes up to the ward. And then he goes to the nurse in charge. And he says, he's come to visit. And he mentions her name. And the nurse looks blankly initially. And then she says, oh, you mean Gabby. We all call her the angel Gabriel because she shines. Now that's what God has in store for us, if we can allow the Spirit to shine through our weakness. May God help us to see the things that are unseen and the glory that is eternal. Amen.
You were mentioning about the when we were in hospital,
John. Well, I can give you my testimony, a little one anyhow, of mine, because over 50 years ago, I had a brain tumour and left me as a vegetable. And through the caring hands of the physiotherapy unit and many other people, it brought me back to where I am today. And it gave me a job, and now I'm in retirement, and I live with my wife, and we can study the Bible more. So I just wanted to give that as a testimony to how people can help you recover.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for that testimony. And isn't it wonderful how those caring hands make such a difference? And that's my testimony too. Any other questions? I can't really see if you can...
Hi, I've got a question. How do we help people in our church who stubbornly refuse to accept that help?
Yes. Well, indeed. And I think this is a real battle, isn't it? Because it's quite close to home for many of us. And I think it's very difficult. I think, first of all, we need to talk about it. I mean, that's why we're having these seminars. It saddens me that these topics are so rarely talked about, they're preached about, that, and yet they're such important topics, aren't they, in Christian living for so many of us. So first of all, we need to lay a foundation of Christian truth. We need to talk about what it means to be human and some of the themes that we've been talking about today. I think, secondly, we need to, obviously, to empathize. I think so often people hang on, they're basically hanging on out of fear. All they can see is loss. All they can see is everything being taken away from them. They so value their independence. And I think, you know, our first task is just to empathize and to understand, yes, you know, help me to understand why you are so resistant. Help me to understand why you're so frightened. What is it that really worries you? Palliative care doctors and nurses talk about trying to find the question behind the question. What's the real question? What's the real fear? And I think trying to help people to see that and then just gently pushing back, you know, and saying, you know, is it possible that God has more things for you to learn? And actually, you know, the positive things that we've tried to outline today, you know, what are old people for? These are the things that God is giving you at this stage of life. And the fact that you're dependent on others is not going to stop you from being the person that God wants you to be, that he called you to be.
Can I ask, you mentioned looking after your mother, which must have been really hard, but you didn't actually touch on what is true of many of us, that we're looking after a spouse when our energies are failing because we are aging too.
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you for the question, and you're absolutely right. So many people are finding that struggle, aren't they, of caring for a spouse who needs very extensive care, often physical, nursing care, and increasingly feeling the load. And unfortunately, this is one of the real challenges in our society, because as we all know, professional services, the NHS, social services and so on, are under enormous pressure at the moment. And therefore, you know, we know that the kind of caring resources that there ought to be available, and that actually under statutory provision there are supposed to be available, in reality, we know that the professional services are so often under enormous pressure. But I think we do need to, therefore, reach out to our support network. You know, I think none of us is called by God to destroy our own selves in trying to care for others. The point is that we're part of a Christian community, part of a Christian family, and that there are resources, wider resources out there, both within the Christian community and within society as a whole. And therefore, we need to make sure that we are asking for help and requesting help and trying and welcoming in other help. And I think, again, there's sometimes a kind of inverted pride that says, you know, only I know how to care for my loved one. Only I'm refusing to let anyone else do it because I'm the only one that knows how to do it. And actually, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's godly. And there's a quote I remember, and that is that none of us are being asked to work a miracle except if the miracle is that we are still there and that we're still caring. So I think it's all about spreading the load. It's all about God has given enough resources in the community. God has given enough resources. You know, the message that I constantly hear in the world of the care is there just aren't enough human carers. You know, there are so many elderly people. There are so many people with dependents. There just aren't enough humans to care for them. And you stop and you think, that can't be right. Why is there a shortage of carers? Answer, because their pay and conditions, their status is so low. It's because they are the absolute bottom of the pile. There's no shortage of people wanting to be lawyers. There's no shortage of people wanting to be neurosurgeons and cardiologists and space cadets. So why is there a shortage of carers? Answer, because they are so poorly resourced, so poorly paid, so poor, of such low status. So the answer is surely to try to change the narrative, to help us to see that caring is one of the most vital and also rewarding. Doing it well and doing it with proper support and so on can be rewarding and bring dignity and worth. So it's changing the narrative, changing our understanding. And this is where I think, as Christian people, we can be on the leading edge. We can be showing a better way not only for us and for our family, but a better way for society as a whole, to recognize that we can care, we can support one another. Otherwise, as somebody who's interested in artificial intelligence and technology, I can tell you the nightmare scenario, and that is there aren't enough human beings, so we're all going to have robot carers. You know, we're going to live in these homes which are completely electronically supported. No human beings, but everywhere we go, there are voices talking at us and supporting us and caring for us and robots putting us to bed and all that kind of stuff. Is that really the kind of future that you or I want to live? I want to be surrounded by human beings, not robots.
Can I just say that what you have said is actually admirable, and I'm convinced that the world is changing, and 50% of the world will be aged and 50% of the world will be young. So there'll be plenty of aged, active people to keep people active. And are you absolutely right that within our own community, whether that be provided by churches, whether that be provided by sports groups, whether that's provided, there is no reason why people can't say, I've got other talents which are not apparent. We are all meant to be on this earth to learn from one another. And we're led by the Holy Jesus Christ. I mean, it is a wonderful thing to be as we are, and we have to accept, and as you rightly say, content.
Yeah.
Get on with it.
Thank you very much. Get on with it. Yeah, that's the marathon runner, isn't it? That's what you have to do as you get the last lap. You don't say, oh, my legs are aching. I've had enough. Sometimes there's a time to say, get on with it. But there's also joy. You know, as we said yesterday, ultimately, this race is about joy. It's not just about gritted teeth. It's about becoming the people that God meant us to be.
For many years, I've been working for SPUC, and continually there are recommendations before Parliament to introduce euthanasia, and they are fighting urgently and continually for this. I remember Lord Joff, who 2 or 3 years ago, his bill was defeated, but he said, I will be back. And that's true. Lord Joff keeps reappearing in different forms by different parties. I just would like to ask for your opinion on when and if you think the Parliament will legislate to legalise euthanasia?
Well, thanks very much. And it's an issue which I've been actively involved in for many years. In fact, I had a debate with Lord Joffe. And as you say, he is absolutely, I think he's passed away now, but was absolutely committed to the legalization of euthanasia. And it is constantly coming back in Parliament. And so I have to say, if you ask me humanly speaking, you know, just as somebody who understands a bit about medical ethics, then I think unless God does the most amazing miracle of revival in our country, then I'm afraid it is very likely that some form of euthanasia or medical killing will be legalized in the UK within my lifetime, maybe within the next 10 years. And that's something that deeply saddens me and concerns me, but I don't think it will be the end of the battle. In fact, paradoxically, if it did get legalized, I can see some opportunities, new opportunities for Christian witness. Because I think, by God's grace, what will happen if euthanasia gets legalized here is that there is such a strength of opposition within the medical profession, within palliative care circles, within many other areas of society, that actually we will be able to mount a very serious pushback saying, not on my ward, not in my clinic, not on my watch, not in our hospital. And I even think it's possible that what will happen is that we will be able to reinvent Christian hospitals, or, quote, pro-life hospitals. And if the government supports Christian schools and Jewish schools and Muslim schools, why can't the government support Christian hospitals for those who really believe that life is precious and life is to be protected? And the one thing I can guarantee to you is that if Christian hospitals get created, and I think there's a really quite a good chance they will, then the great British public will beat a path to the door, because they're not fools. And they would want to be looked after by Christian nurses and by Christian doctors and Christian carers. So actually, yes, there would be loss and tragedy, but there also, I think, would be new opportunities for the power of the gospel, for the power of Christian witness to be revealed in the darkness. Let's pray that it's so, by God's grace.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm part of a group of people in church who support at least one, two elderly ladies. And you may have mentioned it, but for all of us and for one of them, applying for a blue badge was one of the things that helped her so much. And of course, for all of us, we are very excited when it's time for us to take her to church, because we get nearer the church. And the other thing is attendance allowance, which is a seemingly little-known benefit, which is not means-tested, and it's helped her to get extra care. I just thought I'd mention that. That's been a very great help to us.
Thank you very much indeed, yes. You're absolutely right that both of those things are... Actually, the benefit system has many... opportunities, if only we know how to use and are aware of the benefits. And as you say, blue badges, attendance allowance, and various other benefits are available under certain circumstances. So this is why we need professional advice, finding people who understand the benefit system. And I think this is part of what the church, you know, the wider Christian community, we need to provide these kind of resources. You know, as there are more and more older people in our churches, then we need to be proactive in saying, who can we have within the church who really understands the benefit system? Who can we have who's an expert on mobility or on care needs or whatever it is? Because this is the way we show God's love with skin on. We're coming to the end. There's a question from yesterday where we talked about retirement was handed in to me, and it just says this: retirement question couples, different expectations, different desires, different opportunities, how to plan retirement together. And that's really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, there's the famous saying that I married him for life, but not for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So working out how to negotiate this new way of living as a married couple in retirement, I mean, that's something Celia and I are still doing, negotiating this new way of retiring, working out what's a healthy way to live together, where we need space and to be doing our own things, where we're doing things together as grandparents, and so on. So there's always going to be challenge and negotiation, but it's a learning opportunity, isn't it? It's a finding new things about one another, new ways of supporting and encouraging one another as a married couple. I just finally want to mention some resources. There's this book, The Final Lap, which is called Navigating the Transitions of Later Life, which I've written, is available on the bookstall. The Stature of Waiting is a wonderful, rich book about what I was saying about from John's Gospel and the paradidomo, the handing over. That comes from that book. Finishing Well by Ian Knox. There's a book that I'm just finishing called Transforming Friendship, Investing in the Next Generation, that's going to be published later on this year by God's grace. There's the Retiring Well course, and there's Faith in Later Life as a resource hub. So those, most of those are on the handout, and if you want to follow that on. But we're coming to the end now, and I'll hand over perhaps back to Alistair.